This is the Happy Rant Sports Podcast, in which Ted Cluck and Barnabas Piper rant about old sports, new sports, sports books, sports movies, and anything else related to sports that they feel like. Enjoy.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Sports Podcast. I am Ted Cluck, joined, as always, in studio by my good friends and partner in sports radio, Barnabas Piper. And Pipe, as the holidays approach, I hope you're enjoying your Lagares Roasters coffee. Do we still have the Lagares very special deal to promote here as the holiday season approaches?
I think this episode will go up either the last day or the day before the last day. So if you use the code HAPPY20 by the end of the day on December 21st, that's a Friday. So this episode will go up either Thursday or Friday. You'll get a 20% discount on your Lagares Roasters off order, kind of whatever it is. Now, the Happy Rant Signature Blend is the best blend. The Happy Rant Signature Tea Blend is the best if you're more of a tea person, in honor of Ronald J. Martin. May he rest in peace on the sports podcast. But Happy 20% discount, but you have to move fast because it ends on December 21.
Dude, Ron doesn't even know we do these. That's how disaffected and cool he is.
Here's the thing. Ron doesn't know we do this, but he's also disappointed he's not on them.
Exactly. And I bet he listens to every word, low key, just to see if we mention him, you know? So Ron, if you're listening,
sure. He probably listened. He listens to like the first 5 minutes. Cause if we were going to mention him, that's when it would be. And then he turns it off once he's like, oh, they're talking about baseball.
This is boring. I haven't heard my name in a while. So Ron, if you're listening, this is us mentioning you. Merry Christmas. Thank you for the Christmas card with two viewing options. Piper and I are both enjoying those very much, but we're also enjoying sports very much, Pipe. This is a really interesting time of the year for a sports fan. We have baseball trades to talk about. We have my very favorite baseball man crush, Jerry DePoto, general manager of the Seattle Mariners, has been busy. He's earning his money this offseason, making moves. We'll talk about that. But you threw out a topic a couple of days ago, Pipe, that I want to kick us off with, and that is the most annoying fans in sports. And I'm curious as to what you were thinking of, and I'm curious for you as to like what makes an annoying fan. What are some of the criteria?
Yeah, I feel like when I sent you that, there was something that triggered it, and I can't remember what it was. So I'm just going to default to Bears fans,
okay,
as my starting point for most annoying fans.
Talk about that.
Well, so I grew up in Minneapolis, as listeners will well know, diehard Minnesota everything fan. Mm-hmm. And growing up, that meant the Packers were the arch rival of the Vikings. And so I didn't like Packers fans just out of association.
Yeah.
But then I moved to the Chicago area for college, and I quickly learned that Chicago sports fans are way, way more annoying than Packers fans.
Interesting. How so?
Well, first of all, because they have nothing to be excited about, you know, and at least they didn't at the time, because at the time I was there, the Bears had not been good in 20 plus years. Right. And they were just, you know, this was the Brian Urlacher era. Yep. So they were sort of like unpredictably good.
Dude, we had Urlacher. Really we had like Peanut Tillman and
Lance Briggs.
Lance Briggs, Thomas Jones.
Also Rex Grossman, yes. Who was like. He was like the beta version of Jay Cutler.
Yeah,
is really what he was.
Small hands Rex Grossman. I mean, that was always the knock on him from a scouting perspective.
But. Devin Hester, who everybody loved unreasonably because if you can't be good at anything else on a football field, at least you can return kicks.
Rex Grossman took us to a Super Bowl, Barnabas Piper. So,
is that how we're labeling him? He took you there.
That's how we're labeling it. And one of the funnest things about Devin Hester was always. Every single summer, Pipe, you could set your watch by the spate of articles saying how the new coaching staff was going to integrate Devin Hester into either the offense or the defense, and it never worked. Never once.
He was the original Cordarrelle Patterson.
Dude, he was.
Where they're like, no, we figured out how to put him in an offense, and then you're like, no, he can't memorize plays or run routes.
Yeah, he has no interest in being in an offense. So yeah, this year he's a wide receiver. Next year he's going to be a corner. Nope.
Can't do defensive schemes either.
Those were always fun articles to read. A lot of excitement they generated.
So here's the thing. I don't know that Chicago sports fans are the most annoying. They have annoyed me the most out of proximity and rivalry.
Sure.
Because White Sox fans are terrible. Bears fans are terrible. Bulls fans don't matter, and they haven't mattered since like 1998. because the team also hasn't mattered since that time.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, then I moved to Nashville and all of a sudden I realized like, oh, SEC football fans are,
dude, they're pretty bad.
Among the most annoying. And Alabama fans being amongst the worst of them because they're just unassailable. Like, yeah. You can't say anything to a Bama fan.
Well, here's my thing, Pipe. So this is more of a general category of annoying fan. And I don't know where this is coming from. Some sort of deep-seated Midwestern sense of propriety, maybe. But to me, it's annoying when a person, so like a given person, let's say a person who lives in West Tennessee, has absolutely no connection to the University of Tennessee at Knoxville, which is 6.5 hours away. Like, you didn't have any kids go there. You didn't go there. But you're like a rabid, diehard UT fan. Like, maybe it's less annoying, and I just don't get it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't understand why your emotions are being moved by this thing that you have absolutely no connection to. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I've wondered that as well, because I feel like there's amongst college football fans, you're allowed to attach yourself to the state university if you live in that state.
Right.
So even if there are even if you have no, like, I grew up in Minnesota, but I went to Wheaton College, but I can still be a University of Minnesota fan because it's like the official representation of the state.
Absolutely.
Which doesn't speak well for Minnesota, let's be honest. But it's really random because it's a school.
Yeah.
It's not like a brand.
Dude, right. Yeah, it's just a college. It's a place where, like, kids go to class, you know?
Yeah, so, like, I have friends who are graduates of the University of Minnesota, and they're fandom makes all the sense in the world.
Sure.
They spent 4 years and $400,000 or whatever going there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Plus, I mean, let's also be honest, the University of Tennessee has maybe the ugliest color scheme in sports.
Well, dude, yeah. Here's the thing about Tennessee and their older, like, Peyton Manning uniform, like the Peyton Manning era uniform with just a simple block T on the helmet, and they've gone back to that, which is an improvement. But yeah, the color scheme isn't great.
It's a shade of orange that, like, hunters would be embarrassed to wear.
Dude,
that.
Exactly.
It's so ugly.
And anytime I see it in a store, like on a rack, it just looks cheap. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It looks like Walmart quality sports apparel, and it makes me sad. It just low key bums me out to see it. And so anyway, like, another annoying sports fandom thing though is like when you're a UT fan, you have this perception of your program that it's an elite program. And, like, Michigan football fans are the same way.
Yeah, I think we talked about this last episode where they still think they're national champion.
Dude, right? It's like
they haven't been since Charles Woodson graduated.
Right, the dichotomy between the zero sum game program and other programs, and yeah, they still perceive themselves. And Michigan fans would hate me for this as like the elite national championship caliber program. And I think one of the manifestations of that, which makes them an annoying fan base, is if the coach loses a game, they want him fired. Like we gotta get this Harbaugh loser out of there. You know, he lost a game. And granted, he has had trouble winning, like, the big ones in his tenure at Michigan. So I do acknowledge that. But yeah, that fan base is famous for, like, screaming for the head of whoever the coach is, and just wanting them out of there immediately. So I think that makes for an annoying fan experience.
I'm trying to think. There are other brands of it. I think that carries over to professional sports as well, where you get, like, Cowboys fans who are still living on the glories of Troy Aikman's arm.
Yeah.
Even though Troy Aikman has been a subpar announcer for, like, 20 years now.
Exactly.
And they're still, like, America's team. First of all, never been America's team.
Yeah.
That's a label that some news guy probably from the, you know, Dallas Fort Worth Star Tribune,
right,
whatever, Times Picayune.
Yep.
Labeled them with, and they just roll with it. They're like, man, everybody, they think everybody loves their team.
Yeah.
Everybody loves the Cowboys. Everybody loves Zeke Elliott. No, nobody likes the Cowboys.
Yeah.
Except Jerry Jones likes the Cowboys, and nobody likes Jerry Jones. And yeah, it's just, that doesn't make any sense to me. I'm also baffled by, this is less annoying and more, I just don't get it. The American fans of European sports.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Specifically soccer.
Yeah, dude, because that's even a layer more arbitrary than, like if you're a random...
Than you being a Mariners fan.
Dude, yeah, right. Yeah. At least me being a Mariners fan was somewhat based on, like, you know, the inducements of the fine people who listen to this program. So they can, you know, they can take some credit in that. But yeah, like if you're a random dude who lives in the South and you cheer for Alabama, you can kind of get there because it's the South. There's a chance that you could go to a game. You know, they're the most dominant team. But yeah, like a random dude in the South, like a dad who goes to my church, being a fan of like, I don't know, some European soccer team just randomly. Like that to me.
Yeah, like Manchester City is my
dude,
team.
Yeah, Manchester City. It's like
you couldn't find Manchester on a map.
Right. Like, bro, have you ever been to Manchester? No. You know, have you ever been to Great Britain? No. Nope. Yeah, it's a really funny, you know, thing where they like, do they just like the uniform? And I guess that's okay, you know.
Well, I mean, that's like liking, but soccer uniforms are like NASCAR cars.
Yeah.
They're just billboards
exactly.
with numbers.
Exactly. Yeah. It's strange.
Yeah. Probably. I don't,
it's really strange.
And I'm okay with it. So I was talking to a guy recently and he said he was a big soccer fan. And I like threw out as a joke. I'm like, oh, big man United fan. And he kind of looked sheepish and said, actually, yes, that's my team.
Dude, did you push him on it? Said, like, why?
That. Yeah, I said, all right, like we just met. I didn't know this guy well, so I had to be gentle with him. I said, okay, explain something to me as a novice here. How did you pick Manchester United when you grew up in the Midwest? Yeah. Like they have nothing in common.
Fair question. You know,
they didn't even show it on TV when we were growing up.
Right.
And he actually had a decent story. He was spent a semester studying in England.
Okay.
And so it was a, you know, study abroad thing. And he was invited by some fellow Brits to go to watch, I think it was the Man United Man City game. So a big rivalry game at a Manchester United pub.
Okay.
You know, so it's like they got the banners on the walls. Everybody's all decked out.
Yeah.
Just rabid fandom. And he said the experience was so like seminal. Mm-hmm. That he became a fan and followed them since. Plus, he was already a collegiate soccer player, and so he had he had an investment in the game. That's the other thing I don't get is when people are like, "I love soccer," and you know, like they were like a mediocre high school tennis player or basketball player, and they've never played soccer in their life. Yeah. Like the sport is just sort of
it's
the most random thing.
That's the aspect of soccer that to me is proof that. Like the ESPN Kool-Aid works on some people because you can set your watch by ESPN sort of deciding this thing that they want to shove down our throats and get everyone to like. And the fact that there are dudes who didn't play high school soccer, who have no connection to Europe, who are like rabidly caring about these games, like it's proof that that works. You know, it didn't work with the WNBA, which they tried, but like it has worked with soccer. You know, it's worked. And what's interesting about it is, I think soccer fandom has increased in this country, but like our national teams aren't any better. Like the women's team is still good, I think, but like doesn't the men's national team like lose 5 minutes into the World Cup like every
year?
They
didn't even qualify for the
They didn't
most
even qualify.
World,
or, right.
Yeah,
so
like they didn't qualify and they or the next World Cup. I don't even know. I don't know when the World Cup is, but they failed to qualify at some point recently for a World Cup.
Fascinating.
And they turn over coaches like I don't even know who turned. I mean, they fire coaches like Mike Zimmer fires offensive coordinators.
Dude, let's talk about that, Piper. Let's talk about the John DeFilippo firing.
Can I say one more thing about American soccer fans?
Yeah, please do.
So, since I think we've settled on the most annoying sports fans, given that the gravity of the conversation has pulled us this direction.
Indeed.
It is this.
Yeah.
You get the mediocre high school football or basketball player who has decided he's a rabid fan of like, I don't know.
Real Madrid.
Yeah. Just pick, you know, pick a random team with, you know, a beautiful Spaniard playing.
Right.
And then you tell them you don't like soccer and they go, oh, you just don't understand the game.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And I'm like, wait a minute.
Dude, there's some real smugness there.
You were a junior varsity left guard. What makes you understand the game? You smug something or other.
Dude, I think that's the awesome and enticing thing about soccer is that like, you know, really for football and baseball and basketball, there's not a lot of smugness potential. Like those are mainstream sports. They're sports that like, if you grow up in America in a somewhat even moderately sports conscious household, like you understand the way those games work. But soccer allows you to be smug in a way that that none of our other games do. Maybe that's the appeal, Pipe.
I mean, it allows you to be smug in the you got there first way.
Yeah.
not in the game is difficult to understand way.
Dude, but I think you got there first is that's the most current way of being smug. You know what I mean? Like that's the,
well, yeah, it's like the original hipsters were, I liked it before it was cool. Yeah. So American soccer fans, while no longer hipster, are still hipstery.
Yeah.
You know, they wear their scarves and whatever. And yeah, it is a matter of like, they like something that's culturally offbeat and they liked it first.
Right. Yeah. Maybe that's it. Maybe we've quantified the appeal of it.
When I just want to go to them and say, look, stop pretending like this game is so hard to understand. Like there's a reason why we put 3-year-olds in soccer.
Right.
And they have to wait until they're like 6 to play T-ball.
That's true. Yeah.
You know what? There's a reason why 3-year-olds play soccer and they don't play football until they're, you know, 10. Mm-hmm. Because one of these is a sport with the most simple objective in the world. Now I realize strategies and different things are a different aspect, but like the game at its basis is as easy to understand as literally anything besides track and field where it's run around in a circle.
Dude, so question, a little Bovada line here. Do you think that we'll get more hate mail for this conversation? Because I know we're going to get pushback, dude. Because a lot of our listeners are soccer fans. I just have a feeling, you know. Affluent, like, Christian people tend to be soccer fans. And we're going to get pushback. Do you think we'll get more or less pushback than the semi-obnoxious thing that I tried to have Resonate Recordings bleep out, which they succeeded. Hey, Resonate guys, if you're listening, tip of the cap for bleeping half of that word out. So really nice job there, boys. Very comprehensive.
It was like a total setup of Ted. It was delightful.
Oh, that was terrific.
Me.
Yeah, Resonate, those guys just do a bang-up job. If you ever need half a word bleeped out in your podcast, you know, go to resonaterecordings.com and they can get it done. But do you think we'll get more? Which thing do you think we'll get more pushback?
Oh, we'll get absolutely more pushback for dogging on soccer fans. Yeah. And I want to be clear. I'm dogging on soccer
fans. Yeah.
To American soccer fans.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Like, not people who grew up with the sport, not people where it's like their national pastime.
Right.
I'm talking about people who are trying to pretend that soccer is like this high culture, way cooler than it is. You know what soccer is? It's a beautiful game that like 8-year-olds play with a rolled up t-shirt all over the world. That's a certain sort of sublime.
Dude, it is.
But it's not a high-minded upper crust thing. And maybe that's why the U.S. sucks at soccer, because we're trying to get all the preppy white kids to play instead of like,
dude, we are.
Literally
those are the
everybody
softest
else
kids,
in the country.
Man. And I think that's why the rest of the country kicks our, like, routinely beats us in soccer, is because like you go to these countries and yeah, they're playing with a rolled up t-shirt and they're playing all day, man. And you know, we send our kids to these high end camps and it costs $10,000 to work with like, you know, some trainer who played professionally for 5 minutes. But what they really need is to just play, man. They got to want it. You know, I realize I sound like I'm 85 years old right now, but
you sound like you're 85 years old. Except that you're going off of real time, like, hey, visit Costa Rica. Hey, visit Brazil. Visit anywhere in sub-Saharan Africa. Visit all over Europe.
Right.
Like, these are the sports that people play at, like, PE class, because you can do it with 2 people or 4 people.
Exactly.
You can do it with a ball or a rolled up wad of newspaper. Like, it doesn't matter. And we've tried to turn it into this, like, you know, we have club teams and that's how you become elite. I'm like, well, you just ruled out all the best soccer players because they're playing, you know, down on the,
dude, because the great athletes, like the truly great athletes, a lot of them can't afford to be on a club team. And dude, one of the coolest things about Ukraine when we were there adopting the boys, we were staying in these like Russian Soviet era, like high rises in the city. And in the middle of these buildings, they would often have like blacktop soccer fields. And mm-hmm. there would be a net at either end and just a real simple like blacktop field. And dude, there were kids out there any time of the day or night. You know, there was always a game. You could always drop into a game. It was super fun, man. Very cool thing.
Yeah, it's like playground basketball in New York or parts of Chicago where there's just the game runs all the time. And there are certain places where it's, you know, you sort of earn your stripes.
Right.
And some legendary players have come out of there in basketball. We don't have any legendary like, this guy was discovered American soccer players.
We don't, man. Yeah, we don't.
We just don't do that. That's where we find the best athletes in other sports.
Exactly.
Though.
Exactly. No, I know. It's fascinating. Piper, let's transition a little bit because I do want to get your take on some NFL moves of late. Your team, the Minnesota Vikings, have fired their offensive coordinator, John DeFilippo, who failed to get a lot of production out of a really great receiving core, an elite running back, a very highly paid quarterback, if nothing else. And now he is gone. And you guys are back to the drawing board two-thirds of the way through the season. I think your record is, are you guys 6-6-1? What's the record there? In
yeah, which is, yeah, just the quintessential average.
It's the quintessential Kirk Cousins record, you know,
at the time.
This is what we had predicted. And I think the part of it, and I want to get your take on this, Piper, as well as DeFilippo. I think the part of it that kills me the most, quarterback-wise, is that you had, going into the offseason, you had two guys in the building who were beloved by their teammates and their fan base. And you had two really different but really compelling narratives, like, you know, they're potentially in the building, and you let them both walk to bring in, you know, the consummate kind of 6-6 guy. But easy for us to say, we are on the outside of it looking in. Does DeFilippo's firing give you any hope for the rest of this season, Pipe?
No, it doesn't. Mainly for one main reason. Mm-hmm. I thought in the first few games of the year, I thought DeFilippo was doing a really good job getting a lot out of his players.
Yeah.
But the way that football works is that a team does something really well for a little while, and then other teams make adjustments.
Sure.
And so it's like punch, counter punch.
Yep.
I mean, and you see it with the Rams. They started off the season just on fire to the point where people are like, this is a historic team. Now they're getting slowed down by some good defenses,
yep,
but not all-time great defenses. And so the counterpunch has significantly slowed them down. DeFilippo did not make any adjustments,
yes,
it doesn't seem like to me. And
yep,
so, and that's, you know, that's the mark of a coach who either needs time or needs to go.
Yeah.
And I think he needed to go because Mike Zimmer wants a certain kind of offense. And honestly, Mike Zimmer wants an offense that probably sets said quarterback up for success because he wants to run the ball more.
Yeah, Zimmer's always been a big run game guy, and it was just something that DeFilippo had no interest in. You know,
not even a little.
Yeah.
I think they're in the bottom three in the league in attempts.
Yep.
And I'm not a ground and pound 3 yards in a cloud of dust guy quite the same way you are.
Yeah.
But all the best passing games in the league play really effectively off of a running game.
Sure.
You know, effective play action, occasionally breaking the big run. I mean, you look at the Rams, you look at the Saints, you look at the Chiefs, you look at the Patriots, all of them are committed to run the ball in some way.
Yep.
And the Vikings just aren't. They get out there and teams are like, oh, we get to line up against a terrible offensive line and go straight for the quarterback because they just don't run the ball.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's why DeFilippo needed to go. Also, I think why Cousins' production has dropped off.
Yeah.
But the real reason their offense isn't very good is because their offensive line is trash and they haven't invested anything in it in years.
Yeah.
In the draft. They don't have any good young offensive linemen except maybe their right tackle, but he's sort of a developmental guy.
Yeah, exactly. Who's the right tackle?
A guy named Brian O'Neill.
Oh,
they drafted
yeah.
him in the second round out of Pitt.
Yep.
He's a former tight end. So you look at him and you're like, you're about 25 pounds away from being, you know, the proper size for an NFL tackle. He's athletic, but not refined.
Dude, I will say this: Pitt is a great place to shop for offensive linemen. Like pro concepts, they're well coached. So, you know, he definitely bodes well for the future. But yeah, you're right, man. I mean, and you know, DeFilippo wasn't great at scheming up protections that were going to help, you know, the subpar lineman that you had there. So, yeah, back to the drawing board, man.
And the other thing is Cousins is, he's an X's and O's quarterback. I heard somebody describe him this way. Like he's like the running back who will get exactly what is blocked for him.
Yep.
So if you have the right scheme and the right line,
yep,
he'll be really effective, but he doesn't make a ton of plays himself,
yeah,
which means the more he gets pressured, the more he does the quote-unquote smart thing, which is to check down.
Yeah.
The problem is he has two of the receivers in the league who statistically are the best at like 50-50 catches.
Exactly.
Which means just chuck the ball up to Thielen and Diggs,
yep,
at least half a dozen times a game when you're under pressure and make some things happen, and he's quit doing that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it was just a bad marriage, man. It was a bad marriage all the way around, I think. And even from the narrative side, like, you know, and it's easy to look at Bridgewater's preseason or even what Case Keenum has been able to do with a pretty inferior team there in Denver. You know, it's easy to look at either guy and say that would have been better, but maybe it would have been.
See, I think Cousins is better than Keenum. Mm-hmm. I think he caught lightning in a bottle last year. I think it was, I don't think failing to re-sign him was a mistake. Yeah. I do think that, and I've said, I mean, this is not me changing my mind. At every step of the way, I wanted Teddy back.
Yeah.
Because I think they could have signed him to like a 2-year, $25, $30 million contract, something like that. Kind of a make good, but also like good money, but really inexpensive for a starting quarterback. Yeah. I think he could be everything Cousins is.
Oh, most definitely, dude. I think he could be everything Cousins is and then some. You know, I think he's better at creating his own shot, to borrow an analogy from baseball. And you're right. I mean, Cousins is, he's Kyle Korver, you know, like he's a spot up shooter. And if you can scheme him open, he'll make it. But
his record in national TV games in his career is something like 2-12.
Oh, yeah. He's been miserable in those primetime games.
Choke is the wrong word. It's like he doesn't show up. And yeah. I think it was before the Sunday night game with the Bears. And they show the huddle where he's trying to get people hyped, and you know, Drew Brees is sort of the quintessential guy at that, you know, where he gets the Saints just like frothing at the mouth, and Cousins was doing it. And I was like, this is the dad coaching like dude, fifth grade flag football. He's like, come on guys, we can do it guys, be tough guys. And I'm like, honestly, he makes me not want to watch this
dude game. Right. It's not him. It's not who he is. Just don't try to be that guy at all. You know? That is a sad thing when you see the guy in the advent of like a camera and a microphone being everywhere has made this a thing. But when you see the guy who like clearly shouldn't be the rah-rah guy trying to do it, it's bad news, man. It's really bad news. And I wouldn't want to do it. I wasn't a rah-rah guy. Like I was,
no, me
dude,
either.
I was stone silent before a game, man. I didn't like the rah-rah
guy. I'm not saying he should be better at rah-rah. I'm saying he should not do the rah-rah.
Exactly.
Like, Peyton Manning and Tom Brady never did that.
Right, right.
Or never do that in Brady's case, since he's been quarterbacking since 1971.
Well, dude, and Brady's he's like a 42-year-old man at this point. You know, he's not the right guy to be doing rah-rah. Not at all. Piper, I want to lay one more quarterback-related theory on you, and it's kind of come to pass. This NFL season, I think we've seen a lot of the advent again of these kind of pseudo running backs at the quarterback position. I mean, you look at guys like Josh Allen, you look at guys like, of course, Lamar Jackson, Baker Mayfield, Cam, you know, has always kind of been this way, but they're guys who are looking to run, before they maybe make it through all their reads and their progressions, and they're having success at it. And, I want to ask you a couple things related to that. You know, one, do you think that's sustainable? And two, I really think these are exciting quarterbacks and they've been effective and they've led their teams to wins in a way that sort of suggests to me that you either need a guy like that or you need one of these four or five just elite surgical, you know, pinpoint type passers. And if you don't have either kind of quarterback, you know, you've got Kirk Cousins or Matt Ryan or Derek Carr or Andy Dalton, one of these middling guys who really doesn't do either thing that well. You've kind of got nothing. What are your thoughts on that?
If I was to like take it to a 30,000 foot level, I think the commonality between what works, you know, that what makes guys successful is you need somebody on your offense, somebody in charge of your offense, who can make up for the weaknesses of others.
Interesting.
So, like when Matt Ryan won an MVP, it's because they had Kyle Shanahan was their offensive coordinator.
Yep.
Isn't that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And Shanahan is kind of a scheme genius.
Absolutely.
And so he made up for the shortcomings of others, and he put everybody in a position to win. You get somebody like
Dude, he made everybody in that Atlanta offense better.
Right.
I mean, he made a superstar out of Devontae Freeman, who's come back to earth. Matt Ryan's come back to earth. Like, they've really all, besides Julio Jones, come back to earth.
Sean McVay, same thing. Like, Jared Goff is not – he's – at best, he's Matt Ryan.
Sure.
You know? Yep. And he's probably more in the he's like Matt Ryan-ish, maybe Kirk Cousins on the low end.
Yeah,
but he succeeds because Sean McVay can put them all in a position to win. So if you have an elite passer, you have you know, they're making up for the weaknesses of others by kind of ingeniously maneuvering the pocket, putting the ball on a dime, making average receivers into above average receivers. Like Tom Brady's been doing this for years. Peyton Manning did it. Drew Brees does it. Now, those are also in a, you know, there's a good coaching matchup and marriage there too.
Sure.
And the running quarterback does the same thing. Like they tend to have a little bit less success, but they can just, they stress the defense in a different way. So they have to take into consideration that this guy can take off and run, and they create plays that would otherwise not be created. And so again, they're making up for the failures of others. Like the fact that Josh Allen, he's rushed for something like 99 plus yards in three or four straight games.
Dude, he's been incredible. And if you're the Bills and you've got no scary wide receiver matchups, you know, you've got no tight end who can open things up. You have,
I mean, I'm not even sure they have any wide receivers at all.
Dude, seriously.
Let alone scary matchups. Yeah. They have garbage receivers.
Dude, they do. They've got a semi-pro wide receiver group. You know, you got late career LeSean McCoy, a really bad offensive line. You know, Josh Allen is kind of the equalizer in a great way. And, you know, it seems to me at one level, Pipe, that coaches this season have kind of, they've decomplicated the game with guys like that in the sense that, you know, starting at age 9, Lamar Jackson was always the best football player. You know what I mean? And when you needed a play made, you just let Lamar Jackson make it. And probably the same for Josh Allen as he was coming up through the system. So, you know, at some level, you're going, when push comes to shove, I want the ball in Lamar Jackson's hands and not Kirk Cousins' hands. You know, if you're Minnesota, your goal is to get the ball out of Kirk Cousins' hands and into the hands of someone on that field who's an alpha. So an Adam Thielen, a Diggs, a Dalvin Cook, ideally, you know.
I hope their new offensive coordinator remembers Dalvin Cook because he's –
remember,
Thielen's the best player on that offense.
Yeah.
Dalvin Cook is probably second. With all due respect to Stephon Diggs, Cook is amazing, and they just don't give him the freaking ball.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, they need somebody to, you know, really devote themselves to scheming up the run to put the ball in that Ferrari's hands. Absolutely. Interesting. Piper, let's look at these deals the Oakland Raiders made. So they were involved in two huge trades this season. One of which shipped Khalil Mack to Chicago for two first round picks. As a Bears fan, I was very excited about that one. And then the second one shipped Amari Cooper to the Dallas Cowboys for a first rounder. That was one that was roundly panned. They both were really in the media. And Amari Cooper has turned out to be a great piece so far for Dallas. So, your question, and I think it's intriguing. Did everyone win in those deals? So as you look at those deals, the Bears definitely won. You know, they went kind of from good to great defensively. You know, Amari Cooper has definitely given Dallas a piece and probably saved the Clapper's job down there, Jason Garrett. So did everybody win in those deals? Did the Raiders win? And if so, how?
Well, and that's the thing is I think the Khalil Mack trade was one that people looked at, and it was sort of a paradigm setter in that people looked at and they're like, oh, Oakland is completely tearing this joint down and rebuilding. Mm-hmm. And they got two first round picks and then swapped some other picks. It was basically two first rounders for Khalil Mack, which is a ton of value in return. But then 2 weeks later, Gruden is like, man, we could really use a pass rusher. And everybody's like, oh, you mean like the best guy in the league you just traded away?
Exactly.
Like that pass rusher?
Exactly.
So I think Chicago won that in the sense that Chicago would be like a 6-6 team without an elite defense.
Yeah.
Maybe not quite that good. You know, maybe 5-7 or whatever.
Yeah.
Just not – they'd be okay.
Yeah.
But with the defense they have – they can compete with anybody.
Yeah.
And Khalil Mack is the reason why, because they have other good players, and he's the one who takes all those other good players and makes them even better because he's spectacular.
Dude, as a fan of the NFC North, I want to thank Khalil Mack publicly, and Khalil and the Mack family, if you're listening, I know you are. I want to thank you for redeeming the hot garbage that would have been the NFC North had Khalil Mack not gotten traded to the Bears. I mean, dude, the disappointing teams and the disappointing people in this division, there's just no end to it. Like, the Lions are terrible. The Packers are terrible. You guys have underperformed. It's just been a mess besides the Bears. So So I'm happy that he's in the NFC North.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Bears coaches, Nagy has done a good job putting the offense in a position to be better than they ought to be.
Yeah.
Because I don't think Trubisky's that great. I think they have moderate playmakers. Mm-hmm. You know, Tariq Cohen has overperformed expectations, but the defense is the thing.
Yeah.
And that's Khalil Mack bringing it to that level. So I think the Bears won that. But again, time will tell because Oakland got a ton of value out of that.
They did. They did.
So I think it's a Bears win, but not fully determined just yet.
Yeah, exactly. Dude, do you think Oakland sticks with Derek Carr for next year? Because he's looked not so terrible in the last few weeks. And if you had asked me this in the first half of the season, I would have said that Derek Carr was finished. Do you think there's a chance that Gruden sticks with him next season?
Yeah, I think he will because they're already paying him.
Yeah.
I mean, he got an extension. So if they moved away from him, they'd have some obscene amount of dead money.
Right.
I think Carr is a Kirk Cousins, Andy Dalton, Jared Goff-ish guy where if you put him, you know, Mitch Trubisky, put him on an offense with the right coach, and I think he'll perform well. Like, again, just distributing the ball to playmakers, but he doesn't make people around him better.
Yeah.
And again, it's real hard to tell because their scheme isn't very good right now and their players are even worse.
Yeah,
so
their roster is terrible.
Hard to say.
They definitely have the roster of a team that's tanking. And it'll be interesting to see how they use those picks and even where they're playing next year. But speaking of a team that's in the midst of a teardown, Piper, let's talk about my beloved Seattle Mariners. Jared DePoto, true to form, has been he's been Mr. Trade in the offseason. DePoto has never he's never shied away from a deal, and this offseason has been no different. So we had some Mariners players on the move, and I want to get your analysis of a couple of deals. So let's talk about Robinson Cano and Edwin Diaz. So Cano and Diaz go to the Mets in exchange for some pretty high-end prospects, some pretty big deal type guys. One of the benefits of that is that we get to unload Cano's huge salary, and really we were better without Cano than we were with him on the field last season. So Piper, what are your thoughts on this deal?
I'm always fascinated by deals like this because baseball is a weird sport. Like in football, in basketball, if you're going to rebuild, salaries matter so much because there's a salary cap.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you devote too much money to the wrong guys, it just tanks your team.
Yeah.
Baseball is not like that because any spending limit on these teams is pretty arbitrary.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's a self-imposed thing. It's like, we don't want to have a payroll of $180 million, so we're going to cut it to $120 million. Well, you know, maybe that's good business. Maybe it's not. But it's not because there's you're overspending a cap. So to get out from under Cano's contract is – what is the value of that?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. If you thought Cano was – worth having on your team, you would find a way to continue paying him because, yeah, you're right. There's no league imposed limit, you know. Maybe they're of the mind, and I feel like DePoto is this kind of guy. And I feel like this principle is applicable across all the sports. You know, maybe he's of the mind that, you know, Cano is entering the twilight of his career. He still has name value, and there's still the perception that he's a valuable player. So maybe you ship him out while there's still, like, you know, resources to be made on a deal like that. It was a thing, Piper, that I wished the Bears had done with late career Brian Urlacher. As much as I loved Urlacher, I always thought that the perception of him far outpaced the reality of how good he actually was. And there was a moment toward the end of Urlacher's career where the Bears could have gotten first round picks in exchange for a guy who wasn't all that great. And they didn't do it, for reasons unbeknownst to me, but to me, this strikes me as a similar kind of deal where you're moving a guy who's, you know, kind of curb appeal, maybe outstrips his production at this point. And, you know, it's an opportunity to get something back for a guy like that.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a ton of considerations, and a lot of these guys who manage these teams, especially in baseball, are really smart analytical guys.
Yeah.
There's some idiots on there too, but
There's fewer dumb GMs though today than there were 20 years ago, obviously.
Yeah. And there's a lot less sort of like gut feeling decisions being made and a lot more analysis, which, you know, however you feel about that, I think it leans towards better decisions being made. Sure. I think they would look at it and say, you know, in a vacuum, like just performance, Cano's a good player.
Yeah.
But when you take into account he's going to make 20 whatever million this year, he's 37 years old, the roster spot can be given to a young player who's going to develop, who's going to make, you know, $400,000 or $800,000 this year.
Right.
We can get back some value for him, like you said, before he kind of falls off a cliff.
Yep.
And the Mets are in a position where they have some good young players, and they're like, I think we can make a push in this division. And so it's sort of it's the right match. I think, you know, you look at it, you're like, it was a fine move.
Yeah.
You know, trading Diaz was the cost of getting rid of Cano.
Dude, that's right.
Because
that's right.
They had to include him so the Mets could sort of absorb the salary, because Diaz doesn't make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And he's one of the better relievers in baseball.
Dude, so you tell me this, man, because you're more of a baseball guy than me. And as a new Mariners fan, like I want to get my head around this one. So if you're moving an Edwin Diaz, are you just sort of gambling on the fact that with relievers, they tend to kind of regress back to the mean at some level, and you're not going to get the kind of magical Edwin Diaz experience, you know, in perpetuity that you got this year? Like, is that the gamble?
Yeah, relievers are weird because on the one hand, people will trade a ton for them at midseason,
yeah,
you know, because they're like, we need to shore up our bullpen.
Yeah.
That's more like, we need to put out a fire. So there's an emergency aspect.
Yeah.
But like the trade value of a reliever in the offseason is usually not that high,
yeah,
because they're pretty replaceable,
yeah,
especially when you look around the league now and you go, there are 80 guys who throw 100 miles an hour.
Sure.
Now, Diaz had a way better season than most of those guys, but he's probably going to regress to the mean.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to regress to, instead of whatever, 55 saves and a 1.3 ERA, he's going to be at like a 2.4 ERA and 41 saves, which is exceptional, but also attainable by other guys.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's just the ceiling on the value of a reliever is low kind of inherently because they only pitch 60 innings.
Yeah, exactly. So, dude, I want to talk about another big Mariners move. We shipped out James Paxton, who is kind of the star of our pitching rotation last year. I watched a lot of James Paxton games. I wasn't overwhelmed by him, and he gets moved to the Yankees. This looks on the surface like another example of the Yankees just like bringing in another monster. What do you think of this move, Pipe?
Who did they get in return? Because I feel like it was the Yankees sort of number one pitching prospect.
Yeah, Justice,
right?
What's Sheffield. The guy's
name?
So we got the Yankees number one prospect. We got these huge, you know, kind of big ticket prospects from the Mets. So this definitely feels like, I mean, if you're DePoto and you're selling this to the fan base, like it's sort of a rebuild on the fly approach, I guess, in which you take a team that wasn't very bad and you go, you know, we're bringing in all these high end, you know, like high first round type dudes. How would you sell a move like this to your fan base? Because Paxton was a fan favorite, like they loved him in Seattle.
I think there's a couple of things. One is I think Paxton is nearing his free agency.
He is, yeah.
Which means he was going to be outpriced.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he was going to outprice them shortly in the terms of, you know, making somewhere between $20 and $30 million a season probably.
Because
he's a left-handed power pitcher who has had, when he's healthy, has been pretty exceptional.
Yeah.
You know, he's not Chris Sale, but he's really good.
Yeah.
And so I think you look at it and you go, odds are we're going to lose this guy. The other thing is you also look at it and go, if we're going to win 78 to 82 games a season, which is kind of where they've been for a few years with these star players, why don't we win 70 games and spend $35 million less?
Exactly. And develop some prospects who could be legitimate stars for us for a long time.
And in baseball, you can do that.
Yeah.
Like in basketball, if you're going to tank, you're going to be horrific.
Yeah, because draft picks really don't mean anything in baseball.
Not for 3 to 7 years.
Exactly. So yeah, in basketball, if you're in the NBA, you want to tank to such a degree that like you don't screw up a lottery pick. You know what I mean? You're not just good enough to get on the outside of the lottery or outside of the whatever handful of guys that you feel are elite and could move the needle. But yeah, baseball works a lot differently. You know, often in a rebuild in baseball, you're trading a guy with some name value to another team in exchange for the prospects that they were excited about at one time or that they are excited about.
The thing that I will say for the Mariners in terms of how DePoto's done this, that I think if you're going to do this, you have to kind of go for it, is that he didn't make one move, but not the other.
Yeah, that's right.
If you're going to trade Paxton, you better turn around and trade Cano. You better not re-sign Nelson Cruz. You better, you know, you have to move on from these old expensive guys or older expensive guys. Yeah. So that you can go full in on, we're going to have a bunch of 25, 26 and under guys. Mm-hmm. We're going to give prospects a chance.
Yep.
And you know, we're going to rebuild because otherwise you're kind of where the Mets have been, where you have a few young studs and a bunch of just kind of old crap.
Dude. Yeah.
And you're just not good.
This to me brings up an interesting conversation, and we can end with this one, but we can kind of like, We can lay this paradigm over football and basketball as well as baseball. But like, to me, the Mariners made these moves, but they're still a fun team, you know? And I've been trying to quantify lately, like, what makes a team fun. And, you know, this kind of thing, even though they're probably going to be worse next year, like, they're still fun, you know? And there's still a sense of like, things are happening, hopeful things are happening, like, interesting guys are coming into the organization. Whereas you look at a team like the Redskins in football, and they're just not fun. Like, Alex Smith got broken in half. You know, your coach isn't that good. Yeah. There's not a whole lot of guys on the roster to get excited about. Your team's in that like kind of middling moment in a middling division that they can't quite get over the top of. You know, no offense to Redskins fans, but if you are one, you're probably not having a lot of fun. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas this team is still kind of fun.
And you can't go back to the Oakland Raiders. Mm-hmm. The soon to be not Oakland Raiders.
Yeah.
They're an interesting case because nobody does what they're doing, mm-hmm. where you just get rid of all, I guess Buffalo as well, but you just get rid of all the talent.
Yeah.
The Browns are the only other team to try it, but nobody compares themselves to the Browns for good reason.
Dude, yeah, but the Browns are a fun team now. You know, like, they did the huge do over. And they were,
but it took them like 12 years of do-overs.
Dude, it did. Like, they did so many do-overs. Like, they had a decade plus of do-overs, and it's just now starting to work, I think. But they turned their team from a depressing, sad team into a fun team this offseason, really. Like, you know, Jarvis Landry has been up and down. You know, he hasn't been great, but bringing in, you know, Demarius Randle from Green Bay has been great. Both the first round draft picks have been really good. Miles Garrett has been really, really good as promised. Mm-hmm. Baker Mayfield, I think, has been on the high end of what people thought he could be this year. And he's just a really fun player. Like, the Browns are
especially
a fun team.
Especially once they got rid of Hugh and Todd, what's his face.
Right.
And the new offensive coordinator has really put Baker in a position to succeed. He's been completing like 75% of his passes. He's been hitting bombs downfield.
Exactly.
The last, you know, half a dozen games, he's looked really good.
Dude, like, that's a super fun team. In the way that, honestly, like, the Vikings were a fun team last year. You know, they kind of snuck up on people. They had this magical run. You know, you had the, like, scrappy, try-hard backup quarterback makes good kind of narrative. Like, they just had a really fun narrative to run with last year. And even, like, the Great White Hope at wide receiver. Like, a lot of these things kind of coalesced into a really interesting run for the Vikings. But I think the fun factor kind of, and this is where the storyteller in me, Piper, comes out. Like, I think the fun factor for the Vikings kind of left with the two quarterbacks, and it was gone when, like, the Cousins signing happened, because you all of a sudden saddle yourself with all this pressure of, we now have, like, this super high-priced guy, and what was a fun kind of, you know, happy accident has turned into, you know, the onus of all this pressure. And I think they're playing like it, you know?
Yeah. The only way to have fun, if you have high expectations, is to exceed expectations. Mm-hmm. If you have no expectations, like the Browns or whoever, you can be fun by succeeding at anything. And like, that's where the Mariners are going to be this year.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, that's why the Twins last year were kind of uniquely disappointing, because the year prior they had made the playoffs and then they spent some money in the offseason, and then they underperformed expectations because there were expectations. And then it was like, oh, I mean, they weren't horrific. They were like a 75 win team, sure, which is bad, but not historically bad.
Yeah.
And but it just felt like a dog of a year.
Right.
Whereas the Mariners this year, it's going to be like, man, if Justice Sheffield shows anything, if he comes up, right, who do they have? Is it D. Gordon?
Yeah.
You know, D. Gordon steals 50 bases. If Mitch Haniger's good, or maybe they trade him for young guys.
Sure.
Like, there's just,
sure,
they've got that kind of vibe of like, if anybody does good things,
there's a lot of ways
for the future. That's fun.
Yeah. There's a lot of ways that it can stay fun. And, you know, the downside, I think the floor for the Mariners, and, you know, let me know if you agree with this, and then we'll be out, because we gotta get going. But I think the floor for the Mariners, or the moment that you could kind of perpetually find yourself in baseball, if you're a team like that in a market like that, is becoming like the Cincinnati Bengals of baseball. You know, you're perpetually at this like 7-9, 8-8, 9-7 Marvin Lewis kind of level, where you're never really getting over the hump, but you're never really doing a real, you know, tear down, rebuild, reboot kind of Raiders Browns thing. And
yeah, it's the Indiana Pacers, where,
dude, right,
you're perpetually winning between 37 and 44 games, and you're never that interesting.
Oh,
but
yeah,
you're never terrible enough to like make the
league. Dude, the Pacers have been the like khaki pants of the NBA for a decade. You know, they're the beige paint of the NBA in that regard. And yeah, like, they never really go after the big stars, so they never really move the needle that way. That's my fear with the Mariners, is that they could find themselves in that kind of a moment. But
that's where DePoto is an interesting guy to have at the helm, because, you know, he makes more moves,
yeah,
than anybody else. And so
he's never going to keep it stagnant. You know,
this is his version. Like, he's kind of swung for the fences with the signings he made in the past,
yep,
you know, the Cano and the Nelson Cruz and whoever, and like, not enough.
Yeah.
But to a degree. And then they made some midseason trades to bring in guys. Now he's going the other direction. He's like, nope, we're going to rebuild. It's going to be young guys.
Yep.
So I don't think they're going to be the perpetually mediocre.
Yeah.
Because I think they're going to be bad.
Yeah.
But it'll be, you know, sort of optimistically,
it'll
bad,
be a fun kind of bad. Piper, we should recommend a couple of sports books before we get out of here. And my recommendation is one that I know we've talked about on the program before, but I'm rereading it. Now that the semester is winding down, I've got like a couple of days of just kind of relaxed headspace here before Christmas. I'm rereading Moneyball by Michael Lewis. One of my favorites. It's a really interesting, fun read about a lot of the things that we've been talking about today. Player acquisition. How do you value players? What kinds of players move the needle in terms of the kinds of things that you want to do as an organization? And I think it's just a fascinating personal story too, and that Michael Lewis does a great job of putting flesh and blood on some of these more, yeah, esoteric concepts in terms of numbers, and he's done it with a lot of different subjects in his career.
He is the best I've ever read at taking nearly impossible to understand things for a novice,
yeah,
and breaking them into concepts that are completely digestible. Like his book, The Big Short,
yeah,
which is all about the financial crash in 2008,
yeah,
and, you know, the criminal things that happen in the background. I know zilch about finance.
Sure, same.
I also don't care.
Yeah. Same.
And my mind doesn't work that way. And he explained these really complex financial dealings in a way that I was like, oh.
Yep.
Oh, okay. And he does the same thing for baseball in this one. Like, when we talk about esoteric stats, he takes those and turns them into concepts that you don't have to like baseball or care about baseball at all to kind of to enjoy the narrative of this.
Exactly. Yep. Great read. Moneyball, great movie starring Brad Pitt. If you haven't checked those out, definitely check them out. Piper, what's your book recommendation this week?
So I'm just starting in on this one, but I'm going to recommend it. So I don't know enough about it to know if it's spectacular or not, but I know that the author is. Mm-hmm. And it's a book called Basketball and Other Things by Shea Serrano.
Ah, dude, I love Shea. Huge fan.
So it's very hard to describe what Shea Serrano does. Mm-hmm. Because he's just a unique writer in terms of blending sports and pop culture and humor and conspiracy theory and like just movies and all of this stuff into one kind of
dude. He's thread. Kind of he's a less Brett McCracken-y Chuck Klosterman, if that makes sense. He's like a little bit less elitist Chuck Klosterman, and I love Klosterman,
yeah,
too.
And like a way funnier and he's like a way funnier Bill Simmons as well. You know, where Simmons would compare, you know, GMs in sports to like characters from The Godfather or
exactly.
whatever. It's got a touch of that, but he just has his own brand of clever that never fails to make me laugh.
Dude,
he's
same.
So funny.
Same. Yeah, I love Shay. And from a writing standpoint, you know, these are all writers that I interact with in the classroom as a professor. Like, I always use Shay as the example of, this is what it sounds like to have a really distinct voice. And the voice doesn't have to be yours. Like, you shouldn't try to sound like Shay Serrano, but like, this is somebody who sounds like somebody, you know what I mean? Like, this is someone who's figured out, this is what I sound like on the page, and it works for me.
If anybody else tried to sound like him, they would sound awful.
They would.
Like they would sound like a, you know how Bill Simmons has created a brand of imitators, and they're mostly just sort of douchey, annoying.
Right.
Like, they just need to stop.
Too clever for, you know, too clever by half kind of people.
It's all very like campy clever or just like crass clever. Yep. And you're like, you know, just, you're not good at this.
Yep.
If people tried to imitate Shay, they would, it would be like the Simmons thing, except 84 times worse, because he's so distinctive.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, he at least had the writing talent and the chops to be that guy the first time. So yeah, it's a really interesting moment for sports writing, Piper, in that I think we've kind of survived the first wave of Bill Simmons imitators. And the dross has kind of been separated out, but there's some real gold in there, man. There really are some super talented guys, and Shay Serrano is one of them. He's the guy in The Ringer that I always like. That's must read for me, regardless of the subject matter. I'm always in for a Shay Serrano article. So I will definitely check that one out.
I'll say this for Bill Simmons. Mm-hmm. I don't love his writing anymore, because I feel like he's almost a parody of himself at this point when he writes. Well, partly because he just doesn't devote himself to writing, because he's kind of all over the place.
Yeah.
But what he has done both with Grantland and The Ringer is I love it, because he's used his leverage and platform and influence to give these unique voice writers a chance to just do stuff.
Absolutely.
Like, Shay Serrano gets to write crazy stuff. Now, Shay has become like a New York Times bestselling author, and I don't know that he needs The Ringer anymore, but he's part of it. But a bunch of these young sports writers and culture writers and all these different things, some of them I don't like at all.
Yeah.
But they're getting a chance to do creative stuff, because Simmons is like, I think you've got talent, go do stuff.
Dude, totally.
I think that's pretty cool.
I love that model, man. I do. I love that Ringer model. Just collect talent and turn it loose. And little plug for union journalism. That's kind of how I run things here at Union University. So if you want to come and study journalism in a Christian context with kind of a Ringer vibe, that's what you can experience and enjoy with me. And Piper, we have done what we always do on this program, in that we've talked about sports. We've wandered to and fro throughout these topics. And until next time, Robinson Cano.
I'm Don Hawkins, and I once heard Chick-fil-A founder Truett Cathy say, "You can tell if a person needs encouragement, check to see if they're breathing." I'd like to invite you to my weekly podcast, Encouragement for You, featuring encouraging guests like Dr. Greg and Aaron Smalley, Dan Cathy, the late Dr. Frank Menrith, Josh McDowell, and more. To subscribe to my weekly Encouragement for You podcast, go to lifeaudio.com. That's lifeaudio.com.